Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin leads the nation in the production of specialty cheeses, accounting for 47% of the total? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Hey, thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is Katie, HRN Executive Director, and I'm so excited to share with you our coverage from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival.
We are here live today at Charleston Wine and Food.
Join us as we talk all things food.
Come to Charleston, eat some seafood. Eat all of the seafood.
Chicken fried chicken with chorizo steak and salsa verde mashed potatoes.
So quintessentially like Southern fare at its finest.
And have important conversations.
We're also talking about professional women in restaurants and how underrepresented they are, people of color in restaurants, and how they're not talked about.
We get real with Food Network's Manit Chauhan.
Balance is BS. I was told that I wasn't going to be bleeped out.
And find out about raising sugarcane with Chef Sean Brock.
It's like being Indiana Jones or something. You never know what you're going to find.
You'll come away inspired by the power of food and the food scene in Charleston. Here's Dr. Jessica B. Harris.
Food is constantly in flux. Food is always moving. Food is the only real lingua franca that we have that allows us to connect with other folks.
So tune in to Heritage Radio Network on tour at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't go wrong.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guests are Stephanie and Edward Chepe Eselbach from Gut Ogau in Austria. They're calling in from Austria. We'll talk to Stephanie and Edward about terroir, grapes, biodynamics, Gut Ogau, and much more. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Edward and Stephanie Chepe Eselbach from Burgenland in Austria took on the task and challenge of restoring a 17th century winery, a 200-year-old press, and vines that were ignored for over 20 years. What they created was a family of wines based on the personality of these wines with now iconic labels of different family members. Their winery, Gut Ogau, produces living wines with great energy and is certified biodynamic by Demeter. Welcome to the show, Stephanie and Edward.
Hi, thank you for having us. It's so nice what you just said.
Okay, well, it's well-deserved. Welcome to the show. I want to say that back in November during Raw Wine, I had the good fortune of meeting you guys. Sev Peru introduced me to you guys at the Tembels during Raw Wine. So I did get a chance to say hello and slip you my card and, you know, ask you to come on. So it's finally come, and I'm happy to have you on the show. So welcome to the Grape Nation.
Thank you so much.
All right, so
Big thank you to Seth, to Brothers Together.
Yeah, I think she's in Australia. Not Austria, but Australia right now. She'll be back. All right, so people who know you guys and know your wines and know the labels, it's easy for them to understand what's going on. There's that many more people that don't know. So I want you guys, and take as much time as you need, to give us a little background on your journey in life and wine that got you ultimately to restoring and opening the Gut Ogau Winery and, you know, celebrating success now. Where did it start?
The thing is, we are still at the start, if you ask us.
So okay, that's always a good thing.
It starts right now at your show today. But no, we bought this oldest winery in 2007 and started to get everything back in shape. Why we did this is a little hard to tell. It's been only shortly before that both of us met, and I quickly ask Stephanie to marry me. Otherwise, I would have really been afraid of losing her again. So I needed to, after 3 months, I needed to ask her. And then fortunately, she said yes. So it was clear we would spend our life together. And also, we wanted to create and do something together. And I come from a wine growers family. Stephanie is actually from hospitality. So her parents run a very good restaurant and hotel nearby. So we both had some connection to wine. But why we ended up doing this here, what we're doing, is just because we wanted to create something and we fell in love with the place and we saw this huge potential there was. And then finally got going without really thinking into the future. We were just in the moment and we were just trying to express ourselves and express the vineyard.
We were crazy enough to be young and to do such a huge investment in our lifetime and in our life.
I'm not sure that's exactly the way to do it by the business playbook, but screw that. It worked out. So that's a good thing.
If we would have had some business thoughts, of course would have done something else, but it was really the passion and the...
Yeah.
The vision which drove us and in the end which brought us where we are. So we are really happy to have chosen this path without questioning.
Edward, so you were just married, you said. You and Stephanie got together and not long after you decided to do the winery thing, correct? So were both of you full steam ahead? I mean, did anyone have hesitations? Did one of you try to talk the other one out of it?
No, not at all. Not at all. So we were actually, as you say, full steam, the both of us.
Right.
And still up to now, we share the work, we share the ideas, we share the vision. So it's always the two of us. And of course, sometimes somebody has more energy than the other. And
right.
It's the other way around. But right. This is really good the way it is.
So let's talk about specifically where you are. Did you have to look long and far for ultimately... where you set up the vineyard, or you knew about it before? How'd you come about the place you are in now?
We know the place that it was for selling through my mother. She told us that there's such a nice winery and it's going to be sold. And yeah, we saw it and we fell in love, and we also knew that there's so much potential here in this region and in Austria, which is not really taken yet. And this was our idea to show the world the amazing potential of what Austrian wines have.
Right. So give people an idea geographically. So we're talking Austria. We're talking the Burgenland region. And are we talking about, is it the town of Ogau?
Yeah. Yes, Ogau is the town.
The town, and you're not far from a lake, right?
Yeah, exactly. We are on the border to Hungary, and if you like, you know all Austria, but it's not the Alps side what we are in. It's more the very flat area, very I don't know how you call it, very smooth. It's on a second glance beautiful. It's not loud, beautiful. It's not like, yeah, the rest of Austria.
Right. It has its own beauty.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And we're talking about 14 hectares over 32 acres?
Yeah. By now we are at 18 hectares of vineyard.
So you've acquired more land?
In acres, I don't know exactly. But all the vineyards we work on have already been planted.
Okay.
So we didn't plant any ourselves. We took over already grown-up vineyards between 30 and 60-year-old vines, which is for us also important because, of course, they're deeply rooted and they can show the potential of the terroir.
That's terrific.
Even better than young, energetic vines.
I want to get in. Go ahead.
Yeah, and that's why from the start we chose not to go for any new plantings. And right. We're happy enough to once in a while get a very beautiful piece of land which we can add to our production. And that's why we are on 18 hectares now.
Nice. So a little expansion. I want to talk to you about the vineyards and the winemaking. But before that, and I think you may have answered this when we opened the show, when you took over the winery, did you guys have a clear vision of what you wanted to do initially, or you kind of jumped into it and things evolved? Because, Edward, you said, you know, everything is always new, even 10, 11 years later. But did you have a clear vision, or, you know, how did things work out?
No, I mean, we were both very young. I mean, very young. I mean, now, yeah. But we both knew exactly the vision in which we wanted to go. But, of course, we didn't know the way going through. But the idea and how we see wine and the philosophy and the that we are going to work in that biodynamic approach, this was clear for us.
Right.
But at the end, you know, like also with the labels, it was also clear for us, or it felt right to explain the wines like this, but we didn't know that it has so much impact now.
Right.
You know, it was everything what we do is like with instincts and with a feeling what we have, and at the end, it's right for us.
So where you are today is a continued fulfillment of your vision. I mean, you thought about it then, you're doing it now, and you'll continue to grow it. So that's a good thing. You stayed.
Yeah, it's like, I think it's the same like when somebody asks us, you know, what is your future look like, or what's your plans? We don't really know, but it's, you know, you're in a boat and there's the river, and of course you hold your boat, but you don't know where really it goes.
You get pulled a little, right? All right, so I want to talk about, you know, the vineyards. I want to talk about how the wine is made. I want to talk about grapes, you know, so I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions. So let's first talk about the vineyards. I know they were neglected for many years, of which you came in and fixed them, but there was a positive to that because you wanted to go biodynamic, and by the vineyard sitting there untouched for 20 years, it was literally a way to wash away the pesticides. Is that true?
Yeah, it's true, because they haven't been treated in the years before we took over. So talking of conversion to biodynamics, they certainly reacted very positively on this. And also, which is a very important aspect, is there wasn't any fertilization the years before.
Right.
So the vines didn't waste any energy into growth, but they could really focus well on protecting themselves from the start. So the growth is very poor, partly because of the poor soil, partly because of the age of the vines. But all we get, all the plants give us, is what we can take without exploiting. And this is really important for us. So we're not exploiting the soil. We're not exploiting the plants. They willingly give a bunch of grapes every year. And this is good enough for us to really show what the potential of the vineyards is. We're not looking for quantities. We're looking for qualities.
Quality.
And we have a very good balance in the vineyards.
So how hard was it initially to get the vines up to your standards? Did it take a year or two? I mean, was it an ongoing process when you were?
I think it's still a process, no?
Yeah, we can always improve. So there's no, for us, it's not, even after these now 11 years that we've been working on the vineyards, we wouldn't say they are at the level we hope them to be. So it's always improving. There's always more life in the soil. There's more minerality released. There's more healthiness in the plants, in the grapes. So this will continue. We just have to continue working the way we do and being sensitive on the vines. And in the end, this will always improve. So we have a good standard now, but we know there's much more to come.
So that being said, you were still able to grow grapes very early on and make wine. Even though 10, 11 years later, you continue to make things better, you did make wine early on, right?
Yeah, from the start. So the first vintage was 2007.
Okay.
It was the first grapes we picked. So we had all the year with the work of pruning and everything done.
Right.
And yeah, we started with this idea of natural wine already at that time.
Right.
And of course, the work in the biodynamic work in the vineyards. So we had this lively wines in the cellar from the start, and this is what actually also brought us on the on this wine family idea in packaging, in labeling the wines.
Right.
But again, 11 years later, of course, the vineyards are in a different shape, so they release much more energy. They are much more storytelling because the work continues, and of course, the life in the soil is much more intense than it used to be when we started.
Right. So you are now biodynamic. You are Demeter certified. Was that a process that took a long time? I mean, you said your vision was to be natural, biodynamic, you know, organic certified and all that. How long did that take to get, one, the certification and, you know, satisfy you that you were doing it right?
The certification in Austria takes 3 years.
Okay.
And 2007 we started, it was like 7, 8. 2009 we were certified Demeter.
Right. So you set out to be certified right away.
Yeah, but it takes like, I don't know how you call it in English. Like
the conversion.
The conversion.
Right.
Takes 3 years.
Right.
So, and satisfied. Yeah, but for us it was not the certification which made us satisfied. It is more the
sustainability.
The progress in the vineyards. Where we see that it works well, you know, and it brings us to our goal, what we want in the vineyards, to have this liveliness, what Eduard said, and also this very high quality grape, which brings us also to our wine, which we have in mind.
Right. So I want to talk about the grapes and all that, but before that, what are the type of soils that are in the field, what are the grapes growing on, and does it reflect, you know, the taste and the flavors? Are there different plots of different soils, or generally you're planted in similar soils?
No, we have lots of different soil types, and the vineyards are quite widespread, so it's small pieces.
Right.
We have more than 40 different pieces of land, which is typical for our area.
Right.
So it's not one big surface. And so the main differentiation is the vineyards on the flat land, on the plain area. It's mainly gravel soil.
Okay.
But also in our place where we are, hardly any loamy, any fat, any concentrated soil. So this is also poor soil there, very stony, flinty minerality from these gravel stones. And then on the hillside, we have a rather high amount of limestone in the soil, which is from the ancient sea, the mussels of the ancient sea, and some slate rocks as well. So it's a good mix of these two soil types. And on top is also rather poor, so it's mainly sand soil on top. So also not a rich soil, which makes the wines also very straightforward, very sharp.
Right.
And so this is also what we like.
You have a lot of different soil types, which give you different kinds of grapes. So most of your... Is this fair to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, most of the wines that you make are field blended?
Yeah.
Yeah, all of them.
Right. So when you took the vineyards over, what grapes were already planted? And Edward, I think you said you only added, you know, a few hectares, so you didn't plant a lot of new stuff. So what was planted? And I'm guessing that's what you're going with now, right?
Yeah, yeah, and we didn't plant any new.
Right.
It was everything what came more. It was also already planted with old wines, but the grape varieties we have 50% white and 50% red. It's mainly Grüner Veltliner and mainly Blaufränkisch. These are two Austrian.
Blaufränkisch is the red, right, Stephanie?
Yes, exactly.
And Grüner, we know, is really the famous grape of Austria. But there are other grapes out there, right?
Yeah, yeah. So we have Welschriesling, Pinot Blanc, Gewürztraminer mainly on the whites.
Right.
We have Zweigels, we have Rösler on the reds. And in the end, again, the focus is on these Austrian indigenous grapes.
Right.
But since we do the field plants, there's hardly any single grape wines. And also we don't put the grape varietals on the labels because we want the wines to be free in their expression. And it's maybe different in the States, but in Europe, and especially in Austria, if people have a grape varietal in their mind, they are rather narrow-minded regarding the style of wine, and they would expect something which are wines as living as natural wines are not willing to fulfill. They don't want to fulfill any expectations. They just want to tell the stories of the vineyards and the vintages and nothing else.
So even though a wine may have a decent amount of Gruner, you're not going to label it as Gruner because you don't want people to open the bottle and think, okay, I'm drinking a Gruner. You want Gruner just to be part of what you're presenting in that whole blend and the terroir and all that. True?
Yeah, and also that people let loose or let go from these things which we maybe learned about wine. And because wine is so, it's a cultural thing. It's something livable, and people should, let go.
Right.
It's like reading a book. You don't take each word from each other. It's like,
Yeah, it's the whole.
Go with the flow.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you guys, Edward, you may have said this, and explain for me a little. I think you said Austria, as far as, you know, making wine, is not as terroir-driven as, let's say, some of the other European countries, like France, Italy, Spain. Do you agree, and explain what you meant?
Yeah, I totally agree, and this is... So actually, the German-speaking countries, they rather go for grape varietal wines, and the quality used to be for a long time rated by the sugar content in the grapes. So it's a different system from the appellation systems, which is common in the Roman countries, France, Italy, Spain, whatever. So that's also the root of the, so to say, problem. People are focusing on the grape varietal, and they don't accept that, of course, a grape varietal needs to taste differently whether you are, let's say, in the north of Austria or in the south or in the east, because there's a different microclimate, there's different soil. And the indigenous grapes, not only in Austria, but everywhere, of course, why they are here, why they have been kept in the vineyards for centuries is because they can really well express the origin and the terroir and where they come from. And that's the main reason why these grapes have been so successful, and not because they are referring to any character or style of wine. And this has been, in modern times, in modern winemaking, very much the focus. So grape varietal-driven wines are always made wines. So this mainly, the expression is through the vinification, is not through the vineyards.
Right. That's what makes your wines unique. All right, so let's talk about the winemaking a little. I'll set you up and say that you guys are low intervention winemakers. You believe in gently processing your wines. So tell me how you do that, how you achieve that, you know, what you have to do. That's important to you. I mean, you have grapes that you've painstakingly farmed, you're biodynamic, you've got great fruit. Now you're taking them into your cellar, and this is an important thing. So tell me your philosophy.
Yeah, I mean, the most important thing are the vineyards. And we are focusing outside. And what is the most important thing is the perfectly ripe grape, which we bring in the cellar where we don't treat the vines anymore. And if you have this balance in the vineyards and perfectly ripe grape, then you don't, then the work at the end is done.
So when you say you don't add anything, I mean, are you using natural yeasts?
Yeah, it's spontaneous fermented. We don't
do anything
in the cellar. There is no...
It's just the picking, the crushing, the pressing.
Right, the physical things you have.
And the waiting, more or less, for us to give the wine the time to ferment on its own, to finish the fermentation, and then to age as long as it takes to be in harmony and balance again and to be ready to shine in the bottle.
Right.
But there's no interference, there's no intervention. This is just because we think there's so much beauty in the grapes we pick that it wouldn't make any sense to intervene and to interfere, because we would only reduce this beauty and we would make more one-dimensional wines if we would literally make them, if we would just let them age and grow and develop on their own, then they are multi-faced and they have all the beauty which nature gives us.
Right. Now, I had mentioned in the intro when you took over the winery, there was a 200-year-old press. You did, in fact, restore that, and do you use that to crush some of the grapes?
How do you call it?
The old press.
The machine was already in the winery.
Right.
But we restore it, and we produce two wines with it.
Right.
But it takes really long time for one press. It takes like 16 hours to crush one basket.
As much as you don't want to intervene, you also don't want to take forever, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess...
But as long as I have a good bottle of wine next to me and my husband, I don't mind.
Right.
Don't
it'll get you through the day. Two more things on winemaking. So you do spontaneous fermentation, right?
Yeah.
With naturally occurring yeast. How do you age the wines? Are all the wines aged similarly? Not time-wise, but, you know, in vessels? What do you do?
Yeah, we found out that for us the best way to age the wines is in barrels.
Okay.
And we use mainly bigger barrels, which means 500 liters plus.
Right.
So we have 500, 1,000, 1,500, and 3,000 liters.
Are those oak?
By the wood. Sorry?
Are those oak?
Yes, oak. Yeah. We have a very good cooper in Austria, so we only rely on Austrian oak from this cooper. And for us, why the wood is not to get any taste or tannins into the wine, but
neutral.
For us it's really to have the chance for the wines to breathe. So we need some oxygen exchange. We need the wines to develop because they are alive, and
right.
Life can only develop if there's oxygen. For us, it's the best way to age in ferment as well as age the wines in the barrels.
So would the oak, the large containers, help you with natural wines to help them breathe and, you know, get that liveliness? You wouldn't necessarily get that in stainless steel or concrete.
We have a few concrete beds as well, which we use. This is also a nice way to do because there's also some micro oxygenation. For us also, because we think in general wood is something which is more alive. This
right.
is why we prefer the wood. But we have some concrete as well. We wouldn't exclude this at all. But stainless steel, in the stainless steel, the wine is hermetically closed in, and there is no exchange. So that's why
right.
you preserve a rather fresh, youthful idea of wine, but it's really hard for wine to settle and to develop. And this is what we are longing for, because in the end, we want to bottle the wines at the time they are stable, they are harmonized, they are balanced. And that means they need to develop to a certain extent.
Right. Now, I think I came across this, and I'm not sure if it's all your wines, but I read that you treat the red and white grapes the same way as far as leaving them on the skins and fermenting and all of that. Is that true, or is that with some of the wines?
No, this we started in 15 already, and 16 we closed the gap between white and red.
Right.
Because for our idea was like that, I mean, Eda and me, we are thinking a lot, discussing a lot, and we think what we do, and we realize that in the vineyards, we don't make any differentiation between white and red. And who is saying that we have to do it in the cellar? And that's why we said, okay, we don't discriminate one or the other color. We treat them completely the same.
And you get the results. You get the results you want.
Yes. And what we also realized is that with the red, that through them... through the skin contact and for too long leaving the wines on the skin, it's covering so much beauty from the soil and so much minerality from the soil that we realized that, yeah.
That's great.
What we do is we do 1/3 on skins and 2/3 is Thai Express with white and red.
Right. That's a very interesting thing about your wines, and I'm not sure a lot of people know that. You make certified biodynamic wines, which is really, you know, and you've guys said it a few times during our talk, you know, a living, vibrant wine. There's a very large movement towards natural, biodynamic, and organic wines. You guys witnessed that at the Raw Wine Fair. How many producers, how many people? So the popularity is incredible. When you come to New York and a place like Brooklyn, people go nuts for it. There are wine stores just dedicated to it and restaurants. And there's a reason why, because, you know, the product is so good. But I had a few questions. I think some of the knocks or criticism that natural wines get are consistency, such variation in vintages, and even the potential of ageability. How do you address those things?
So for us, in the end, we don't want to be the natural guys and there's the other wine world. For us, it's all wine. And as grower, you simply need to make a clear decision and you need to know what you want, whether you work conventionally, whether you use chemistry, or whether you work organically or biodynamically. It's a clear decision you have to make. In the end, our wines, they should compete with the rest of the wines in the world, which are in an artisanal production. This is a more crucial differentiation for us, because an industrially produced wine, of course, will be standardized in taste, will always taste the same. It's more like a drink than an agricultural produce. But if you work with the soil, and if you are, especially in a region where there's a difference in vintages and in weather and climate, whatever, there is nothing more beautiful than having, in the end, a non-consistent produce, but something you would always rediscover and you would never have the feeling to know in detail. Because comes the next vintage, again, you would have to relearn the beauty and rediscover it. And that's actually what we as growers do, because every spring, now springtime is coming, so the vegetation season is starting. We have a certain clue, of course, but we don't know what will be the outcome in autumn. We just go for it. And the same is what we suggest to open-minded consumers. This is not a disadvantage. It's an advantage of the living of the natural wines, that you don't have the consistency, but you always have the new experience to taste and retaste. But, of course, the but is, and this is also what is always criticized, of course there's some wines which are not good, which don't age well, whatever. This you have in all the wine world.
True.
So there's nothing special for the natural wine.
True.
There is wines which don't age well because the grapes are not healthy, because the vineyards are not in the sane, in a healthy condition, and there's not the energy the wines need to protect themselves. We have this healthy grapes. We don't need any medicine to protect them. We don't need any sulfites added or whatever. So this is a clear and healthy produce. We can guarantee a couple of years in the bottle to age them well. We can't guarantee 50, 60 years, but
right.
If you long for this, it's always a wine with lots of vinification. Otherwise, a fermented grape juice doesn't really long to age that well. I mean, it can happen once in a while, but this is not what necessarily needs to happen. But if either you add lots of sulfites or you do an overdose of skin contact, then you can get to this point. But if you're longing for certain harmony and balance, you don't necessarily have to have this potential, but you have a certain potential of, let's say, 20 years for sure to age them well.
Edward, well said. I mean, certainly a philosophy and a practice I know you follow. And I think a lot of people who don't know much about natural wines or the importance of the land or how the wine is made. I think in answering that question, you addressed a lot of things. But in the end, it's not about labels or titles. It's about putting your head down and making artisanal wines. And I agree with you. All right, guys, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about a few more things. I want to get into the labels, which I think is a very important part of Good Old Gal, and a few other things. Then I want to ask each of you to answer my wine list. So we're talking to Edward and Stephanie Chepe Esselbach from Gut Ogau, and you are listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Sartori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back to The Grape Nation. We're talking to Stephanie and Edward Chepe Eselbalk from Gut Ogau. They are in the Burgenland in Austria, and they are making a very exciting line of wines that have gotten incredible notices. They're limited wines, but they're available at some great restaurants, certainly in New York and parts of the country, and they are in some better wine stores. So, guys, I want to talk to you about something that is very visual, and that is after you've done everything we discussed, which is planting and growing, vinting and bottling and all of that, you have this very eye-catchy, stunning concept with your labels. So talk to me about the story behind the labels, and then we'll try to describe them to people.
Yeah, the story of the labeling actually is quite simple, because when we started in 2007, our first vintage, we didn't really have any clue of the outcome of whatever we were expecting from the vineyards and the quality of the wines, the natural approach, whatever. But what we realized when we had the first wines in and they were fermenting and after fermentation was a very, very particular liveliness in the wines, also at that point already. And for us, we found that each wine was so unique in personality and character that we said, why wouldn't we describe the wines as if they were persons when they are for us these strong personalities? And that's what we did. So we put a personal profile on each of the wines and then created faces according to these personal profiles. And so the faces on the labels, they are fictional. They are not any reference to our living family or any working persons or whatever. But it's just the expression of the character of the wine transferred into a face. And the wine family in three generations is according to the natural potential of storytelling of the vineyards. So there's vineyards which would always give us rather youthful, energetic wines. And there's vineyards which would give us more life experience, more settled characters. And that's how we differentiate these different wines.
So you have the three generations, or you have grandparents, parents, and kids. And you said that the wine labels with the younger members of this family are the more youthful, energetic wines. And as you move up, do you use the 200-year-old press to press the grandparent wines?
Yeah, the grandparents we press with the old tree press.
Right. So that matches everything. So there are 10 wines, 10 family members?
Yep. Yes, yes.
How does that break down? A couple of grandparents, then where does it go from there?
I think normal, crazy families, you know?
Right.
It's like all mixed up.
Right. Is there any truth or resemblance in any of these stories, characters, drawings?
No, the stories also you must not take too seriously, but for us it was important to show And this is also something which is crucial with this wine family idea. On the one hand, we are not longing for perfect wines. We're just longing for the best expression of the vintages and the vineyards. And so also these wines and the characters of the wines and the personalities and the faces, they are not perfectly modeled. It's not everybody's darling, so they can be a little grumpy sometimes. And they're also not too easy to approach to a certain extent. So these are partly also introverted, reluctant characters. But this has nothing to do with any living person.
Okay.
So it's all according to the wines. And with the storytelling also, we wanted to show that, again, these wines are far from being perfect. They're just interesting because of their strong, firm characters and the stories they can tell.
So, Edward, you're saying people are imperfect and so are not the wines. Fair?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, on each wine, there is a little story on the back about, you know, the character, the style, correct?
Yes.
And the drawings, and it's fun to see all 10 bottles together. And when I promote and post the show, I'll put that on our Instagram and Facebook. But they're line drawings. I think I read somewhere, and tell me this, you brought on, was it a local artist or a friend to do the drawings?
No, it's big. I was in an art school.
Right.
And I studied photography, and it's a friend of mine.
Right.
Who did the drawing.
So you had a friend do it. Now, here's the thing that I read that I wanted to ask you. You're, I don't know, 10, 11 vintages into the wines. Do you age the character and the line drawings with time, or are they the same?
No, they stay the same.
They do. I thought I read somewhere that you age the character.
No.
No. All right.
So what is crucial in our approach, as you already mentioned, and which is correct, we do field blends. But every vintage, the same vineyards go into the same wine character and the same personality. So in the end, we have a strong recognizability of this character of the wines because of the soil, which is the constant level every vintage. So the vintages do make a difference. Of course, sometimes the wines are a little more extroverted, sometimes
right,
a little more introverted, whatever. But in the end, the strong character and the personality behind is the same because it's driven by the soil.
Right.
So and so the family can or could so far also stay visibly the same because we always felt this personality every vintage in the wines.
Right. One question to that. Do you tweak the percentage of blends each year, or you know, will you stay at 60% Gruner on one of them all the time, or you'll go up and down based on the vintage?
No, because sometimes we don't even know how much percentage it is.
Right, so that
because
varies.
Because we take everything what the vineyard gives us, and we put it together. We pick it together and ferment it together.
Right. One last thing, and then I want to ask you my wine list questions. What do you guys think drove such incredible interest and sort of created this cult-like following for your wines? I mean, it's really been it's probably one of the most Instagrammed wines. You know, it's a Somm favorite. So I'm guessing that Somm's had something to do with it, being at wine fairs, the labels. You know, people look at books and they see a label, they buy it. They'll look at a wine. Distributors, you know, if you have the right to. What drove this, like, recent, you know, in the past few years, it's been meteoric. Do you have any handle on that? It's good, but what do you think?
PR agency, anything? No, but what we think, I mean, of course, we sometimes question it ourselves because we don't really know. I mean, for us, it's great.
Right.
We have this impact, but we don't really know exactly. So everything is important and nothing is important on the same hand.
Right.
Because what we do with passion and emotion. And obviously, these emotions, they are really transported in each bottle, and we get amazing feedbacks, not only on the social medias, but also direct feedback from all over the world by people having our wines and memorizing them.
Emails and
right.
It was the best wine, and it's really sometimes for us also incredible, and we have to I don't know how we have a saying like that. We have to take each other because we, for us, it's also incredible that people are so reflecting on our wines.
But yeah, it has been.
But we have a very humble point of view on this because, in the end, it's a very consistent work we do. We don't make any compromises. What we promise is what people find in the wines, and that's also probably crucial.
Right. I agree with that. All right, I want to ask you guys, I want to move to our wine list. I want to ask you guys a bunch of questions. I want to get an idea of what you guys are drinking. So I'm going to ask you a question, and each one of you answer it. It's about five questions. We'll buzz through them. So besides drinking and tasting Gut Oakau, what wines are you guys trying and drinking now? What's on your table? What's interesting you? Is there anything seasonal? Stephanie, what are you drinking now?
Now I drink, because we just came from Sicily, Vino di Anna.
Okay.
One of my favorite wines.
All
right. Right now.
That's a good one. Edward?
Of course, I'm happy to share bottles with my wife.
Okay. So the boat. Anything else?
On the same hand, so talking of Italy, for example, Le Coste from Lazio is also one of our, at that time,
nice,
favorite wines to drink.
Great. Good to hear that. Now, this will be a collective answer. You don't have to answer it individually. Do you guys have a favorite wine and food pairing? Is there something you come back to? Is there something that when you cook and match it with the same wine, you say, oh, wow? Is there a favorite?
No, because we never go back to this, what we had already.
Okay. You're always moving. Not even.
It would be too boring.
But not even champagne and oysters? I mean, you don't have a favorite thing?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right.
Not really.
All right. You're right. You guys are boring. All right. Now, probably you're going to have to answer this with a European answer, maybe a local answer, but feel free to answer it with, you know, any place. I always ask my guests, tell me your favorite wine restaurant and or bar. You know, a place that you go to that has an incredible selection of wines. They're knowledgeable about it. You know, they have good food or it's just a good wine bar. Do you guys have a favorite, whether it be locally or in another country or the U.S.? Is there anything that stands out to you guys?
For us, it's, to be honest, a little hard to answer this because we have the chance to travel a lot and we see so many beautiful places with passionate people and burning for the idea of our wines and the wines of fellow growers. So it would be quite unfair to just name one or even name 10 because there's thousands of really, really great places around.
A lot of times I have to tell my guests, you know, I'm not asking you that to incriminate you or sort of leave anyone behind, but, you know, every now and then somebody has an opinion. I think the good news is, and you'll agree with me, there are a lot of places like this. True?
More and more.
More, yeah, than ever. All right, so.
Yeah, but what I would also, I mean, I would give you a place, of course. It's in Austria. It's called Restaurant Taubenkoben.
Spell that for me, Stephanie. Spell it.
This is Taubenkoben, and this is the restaurant which my parents own.
Ah, yes,
my
I know
sister
it.
And her husband running the business. And my mother started already 30 years ago with a really amazing wine list with biodynamic and natural wines already. And my sister and her husband are now running this place.
Nice.
This I would, of course, say that it has to be a place to be.
Right.
And I would agree.
Totally. I'm glad you mentioned that. All right, two more questions quickly. Do you guys have, each of you, a favorite all-time wine? Is there a wine you've drank during your adult lifetime that just transcended you to somewhere else? Can you pin it down to one or two, or, you know, any wine that you felt so strongly about, Stephanie?
I just think about. I mean, there are two wines because one is Emidio Pepe, also a wine producer from Italy.
Okay.
And then there's Coutois, and these are two wine producers who we love, and we love to drink.
Okay.
And yeah.
Edward, you agree?
I always agree with my wife.
Okay, I'm not gonna. Now, Stephanie, the second wine, will you spell that for me so I know what you mentioned? The second wine.
Which one?
The second wine that you mentioned.
Julien Courtois from the Loire Valley.
Got it. Okay. All right. Last question. I ask my guests, you know, what's the best wine that's a great value? Usually I ask them about, you know, $15 American and all of that, because there are some terrific wines at great prices, but some are better than the others. I'm not going to ask you for a specific wine or even a price, but in your guys' opinion, what do you think are the great value wine opportunities? Like, for instance, Muscadet is a terrific wine and it's reasonable. What else do you think?
Of course, Good Ogal.
But
very reasonable.
No, we know that. That's but beyond that, I mean, Gruner. Would you agree? Gruner is a great value for the money.
Yeah, we've traveled recently and also in contact with lots of fellow growers and friends in south of France.
Yes.
And here you find some amazing growers, which are more or less sometimes only at the start.
Right.
But for us, I mean, what does value mean? So value doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be at a low price. Value can also be a high-priced wine, can have a very good value, because it's always a question of the work behind, the effort the growers making, the surroundings, the preconditions in the vineyards, whatever, the emotions which the people put inside, whatever. So that's also a question for us. If you ask for what is a good value wine, we wouldn't say it has to be a rather cheap wine. It can be also
right. That's why
else.
I don't use the word cheap. But yeah. I'm always out on that quest for a great bottle of wine that is not that expensive. And, you know, next time I should sort of mention that, you know, it should be from people who are sustainable growers and low interventionists, because then you really get everything. So I
yeah, that's true.
You are right.
I agree with all of that. All right, guys, we're going to wrap up the show. Thank you for answering my wine list questions. I'm going to post them in our social media. That was Edward and Stephanie Sheppe Esselbach from Gut Ogal. They answered that. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. You could follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. We'll post Stephanie and Edward's wine list answers on our social media sites and any other information on Gut Ogal. You can follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby, and you could now follow hashtags. So follow the hashtag The Grape Nation. And on Twitter, we're at BenRuby. Edward and Stephanie, if we want to find out more information and we want to follow you guys and the brand on social media, where should we look towards?
The easiest is on Instagram.
Okay. And the Instagram account is?
It's Gut Ogal.
Gut Ogal. Okay. That's GUTOGGAU. So that would be the best place to go. All right. I want to thank my guests, Stephanie and Edward Sheppe Esselbach, from the winery Gut Ogal. I want to thank you for taking time out of what I know is a very busy schedule. I've been kind of tracking you, and I think you guys have been on and off the road a lot lately. So thanks for sitting down. I want to
thank you for having us.
Thank you. I want to thank our engineer, David, who's helping me today, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food Radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.